great snake-eyed sawtooth beast we call the animation industry rolls over the landscape just a-chopping and a-slicing and a-deflavorizing all in its path. We pause to remember them furry, more independent critters running for their lives in its wake. The ones doing it for the love, trying to make the rent, trying to make the footage count, trying to get bought by Nickelodeon, trying not to get bought by Nickelodeon. As they cross the flaming desert to the great temperature-controlled vault where the grapes of wrath are stored. This is their story. These are their words. This is a rare photograph of Calvin Coolidge when he was arrested for being a bootlegger. It's the Animation Show Podcast.
You're listening to the Animation Show Podcast. My name is Taylor Jessen, and I'm talking to Dave Carter, the creator of Psychotown. And the first question I have to ask you, Dave, not just because it affects your process as an animator, but because it affects this very phone call, is that you are deaf. You have a cochlear implant. Can you talk about the extent of your deafness? How is your hearing now, and when did you first hear?
Well, I didn't hear anything until I was 8. So, nearly up to then, I was pretty much living complete silence, and so ultimately that's kind of had an effect in the way I sort of see the world, and obviously everything's so visual, and it's still very much, even if I've got the implant nowadays. Yeah, so I guess it's programmed this sort of visual orientation way of seeing, you know, things.
So I guess you learned to lip read from an early age.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I never learned sign language, so because my mother decided that it was going to be to ostracize me from the real world, you know. So she insisted that I would learn to lip read. And so, yeah, that's just been my main mode of communication. So lip reading has sort of been paid off in a good way because I'm pretty good at lip syncing. Because I can tell when it's not right, when I animate it.
So, I mean, you have a really clear speaking voice, all things considered. So, I mean, how did you get to where you are now? Was there a lot of therapy involved?
Well, actually, the story goes that when I was diagnosed as being deaf, I also have dyspraxia, which is a condition where you are unable to speak. So I was theoretically a mute, and so the doctors had told my mother that I would never be able to speak, and we had to utilize sign language, but my mum was pretty much in denial and considered me to be perfect in her way, and so she insisted that I would go to a special school, and she tracked down schools all over the world where they had a program to teach children with dyspraxia, not necessarily deafness, but those who had motor control problems, and my mum was concerning the lips. So she took me to Holland when I was 3 years old, and so I was there for a few months, and then we started making progress. And so theoretically, I started speaking Dutch. So they decided that it'd be better off if I went to Canada. So from then on, I went to school in Ottawa. So we picked up the program in Canada, and Mum had to teach me speech therapy daily, 3 times a day for 13 years. And so that's pretty much why I can talk now, because of my mother's persistence of teaching me.
Are you usually comfortable on the phone, or is it ever at all awkward?
Yeah, I'm used to reading people's faces as I talk, and it feels like, you know, you're talking to just a wall, you know. So that's why I kind of maybe freeze up. Yeah, I don't normally have long conversations. I talk for extended periods of time. If I talk on the phone, it's more or less just getting the dates, time and place where to meet friends, you know.
So I guess the big question is, what's your overall philosophy about sound in your animation work?
Well, it's always secondary. I just, obviously, with the stuff you've seen, it's been very visual-based, and the comedy is just pretty much gag-driven, so ultimately the sound is pretty much supplementing the gags. I think that sound is paramount to animation because it grounds it into a reality. Without sound, it's just complete fantasy. So I value sound as just as important as the animation, but when I start with it, it's always in visual terms first.
So in the Psychotown pieces and some of your other work, you're not doing this a la anime. It's the audio track is recorded first, right?
That's correct.
So in the studio, what's your process like? Do you animate to a waveform?
What happened is I ultimately I know the script by heart, and I wouldn't be able to do it if I didn't know the script verbatim in every line, how the lines are pronounced. What happens is that I have the soundtrack as a WAV file, and I can see it in the timeline in my software, and what I do is I cut it up, and then I put it into my frame grabber software so I can see all the wavelengths down the column. And basically, I can't, I need to have the script in front of me to actually know where I'm at with the script, because I can't actually hear the playback. I just know, I'm just judging by the rhythm of the wavelength where we're at, so I know where the pitches are, where the voices are accentuated. So basically, I'm just sort of doing it blindly, but at the same time, I'm just using the script as a guide and then just following the wavelengths, but I can't actually hear the playback. Understand the playback, yeah.
There's wonderful subtle acting through all your work, but I especially love the business that you have for your characters in the piece, How and Why I Produced My Submachine Gun. So it really comes as no surprise to me when you describe how basically you've been acting from a very young age.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot to do with the fact that I couldn't understand people from a young age. It's just that I always demanded to be the center of attention, because if I couldn't follow what was being said, at least I could dictate conversation and dictate what was happening around me. But of course, I couldn't really talk until the age of 3 or 5. So up to then, I've been, fully around physically, so that way I could draw attention to myself. So ultimately, I think there's sort of that in me where I just like to perform and draw attention to myself. So, and I don't think I've been able to set it off.
So obviously you've always been really attentive to body language.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Again, it's been a good tool towards what I do right now. So I think I think so much more can be conveyed through body language, and that interests me more than dialogue itself. So it's more kind of like it gives you more intelligent dimension to your work.
In addition to directing our listeners to thedavecartershow.com, where you can check out all things Dave Carter, I should also invite our listeners to Google The Nice Guys at MySpace, the Nice Guys being a sketch comedy group from Sydney with whom you collaborate a lot. One of the guys in the group is Nikos Andronikos, and he, in addition to being a disgustingly talented musician and comic, has also done music and sound design and voice work for a lot of your animations. How do you and Nikos know each other?
Well, actually, Nikos and I have known each other for a long time. We grew up in the same neighbourhood and went to the same primary school, went to the same high school, went to the same uni. We lived together, so ultimately there's that line of connections, but ultimately I'm probably personally with Nikos. But Nikos, he's very talented in a lot of other areas, like he's a terrific writer and he's in a band, so he can put together some really wonderful soundtracks for my work. And so it's just been great to have someone who's on the same wavelength with me, and I think it's important to share your work with a colleague, because doing it solo can be pretty lonesome.
It really feels like a true collaboration. I mean, you're making their work stronger, and at the same time, they're making your work stronger.
Yeah, well, Nikos is part of this comedy team that's been doing some roles and podcasts and so on. They started with a stage show which I've been running for 3 years at university, and ultimately I just wanted to tap into their talents and collaborate on that. So that's why I've done a few projects with the Nice Guys, because once again I think it's really great to actually take up some of the baggage and share it with equal-minded people, because up to then I think I was a bit tired of carrying the baby on my own. So I thought, well, it's actually a good experience to share around. You can get rid of your ego for starters.
When you first had a real body of work, you put it together in a screening for Friends, and the response was pretty good, you described. But the very first time that you played Daddy and James for Mom and Dad and the Family, the response was kind of cool.
Yeah. When I started my first stop-motion project, which was Daddy and James, and I had animated for 2 years up to that point, so I was so excited to actually show my mum and dad and my sister, this sort of coming out again, because I had gone into kind of a hiatus from after you know, this grueling honest project that I had done for an entire year, and that just sort of put another animation for me. Anyway, so I made that in James, and then got my mum and dad and sister around, and the response was not very flattering. That mum had said, you know, to never make a film like that ever again. So I tried to explain to her that if you, you know, project a film in the with a audience, then the response would be entirely different. So basically, the whole point of that screening was to prove my mum and dad that ultimately, I think Dad and James alone would hold up if you had a collective response.
I like the piece a lot, but I'm always a fan of nightmare surrealist comedy, so there you go.
Yeah.
You've name-checked Terry Gilliam as a major influence. What were some of your other big inspirations growing up?
No doubt the Warner Brothers animations really inspired me completely growing up because it was just so incredibly visual over what was being screened in the 80s. So a bit rather was the Coyote, you know, 1,000 times over, the Smurfs. So from that basis, that's pretty much what attracted to me to animation, but more so in the last few years I've been more drawn to live action filmmaking for influences, because I think that animation is first and primarily filmmaking. It's a filmmaking medium, so we should look back to animation itself, otherwise we'd be recycling ourselves, which I think is detrimental, since so many animators continue to look to the Warner Brothers for inspiration and try and replicate that, and I think that's it's like a eating your own tail. It's just going around and around. So I think it's important to look to other areas, and animation is inherently a postmodern medium, so I think that's what we need to do, is to draw influences from many places beyond filmmaking.
Are you as comfortable working with paper cutouts as you are in a digital medium like Flash?
Cutout is a much more preferred medium than working digitally, even though I feel that I can handle digital type animation proficiently a bit. But what draws me to cutout is that it's much more hands-on, it's more tactile, it's a tangible approach to animation, and I was so sick and tired of having this sort of, it felt like a prosthetic device between myself and my work, working in Flash, and I was so tired of that distance, so I decided to turn to cutout because I could actually hold my, you know, characters and creations and then animate. So I think it does have a great result when you watch it, because in a way what you're seeing actually took place at a frame at a time. And I think trying to foreground it in some kind of reality is so important, especially in comedy. So I think that you really need to emphasise some kind of weight. And so I think when you've got shadows into play and you've got some textures, you've got depth, I think they can give it all that kind of the retro realism.
I have not seen any of your new work for Animation Show 4. Can you give us a little tease?
Well, what I've done is continued with some more Psycho Towns. So I've created two more episodes for Animation Show 4, and I would say that I've sort of stepped up a level with production design, and I think the script's even better, and I think the jokes are strong. So I feel like I sort of stepped up standards a bit. Ultimately, because I think from what I've seen with the previous shows, they've been really, really polished work, so I felt like I had to get up to scratch. But normally, I prefer to take the crude approach. I prefer to show that there wasn't too much pre-planning and discipline with the production, but I think there's still I didn't compromise too much of that the initial rawness of Psycho Town.
Cool. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for talking with me. I know this can't have been the easiest thing. It's a bit of a longer phone chat than you're used to. I really appreciate your talking to us. Again, this is the Animation Show Podcast. My name is Taylor Jessen, and I've been talking to Dave Carter, creator of Psycho Town. Dave, thank you very much again for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Taylor.